Hello, welcome to this interview. I'm Megan Gibson, co-host of the Trauma Super Conference. Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with Dr. Daniel Siegel, a clinical professor of psychiatry at the UCLA School of Medicine and the founding co-director of the Mindful Awareness Research Center at the University of California, Los Angeles. An award-winning educator, he's a distinguished fellow of the American Psychiatric Association and recipient of several honorary fellowships. Dr. Siegel is also the executive director of the MindSight Institute, an educational organization which offers online and in-person seminars for individuals, families, communities, and can be enhanced by examining the interface of human relationships and basic biological processes for human development. So Dr. Siegel, thank you so much for being with us today.
Megan, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So we were talking just before we started recording that I just finished your I think newest book, correct me if I'm wrong, but Interconnected, which we'll talk a little bit about. But there's one thing I didn't mention in your intro there is that you've written a lot of books and co-written a lot of books on a variety of subjects. But I want to start by asking you about this term MindSight that you created. Which I understand to mean the subjective life of our mind and the understanding of others' minds. Did I get that right?
Yeah, you did. The ability to sense that, to perceive it, to have sight for it, the mind sight. Yes.
So I love this and how it relates to trauma, since this is a Trauma Super Conference. And because, you know, lots of people who've experienced trauma of various types develop what we kind of call like spidey sense or extrasensory kind of like perception around about their environment, the people in it, and things like that. And so how does MindSight play into this sense of self and for those who have developed trauma?
Well, in a number of ways. I mean, the first thing to say is that the ability to sense your own inner experience and to be able to do that in a way that is with empathy and compassion, a positive regard, is really sometimes challenged when we beat ourselves up for painful things that have happened and we take responsibility as if we had caused them, like if we're children being mistreated. We will say, oh, it's my fault. I'm the one who made this happen. So MindSight would be the ability to not only sense those feelings, but then have a kind regard for yourself. And that's a part of something we call integration, where you're allowing things to be different and then to make connections across those differences. So kindness is one outcome of integration. And so MindSight is basically that way you can have insight into yourself, empathy for others, and kind, integrative kind of stance to one's inner life and the life of other people.
I love the way that you said that too, because that self-compassion piece seems to be the first step, I think, on any trauma healing and trauma growth path.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think sometimes, you know, the inner compassion is what I would like to call it, you know, where you realize yourself is both inside your body and in your relationships. So we would say, you know, there's an inner compassion you can have. There's an inter compassion, you know, relational compassion. But then also realize that sometimes when people have been traumatized, you know, knowing the mind of someone who's intentionally trying to hurt you is actually not so comfortable. Because when you're perceiving their mind and they're really with intention, strategically, purposefully trying to inflict harm on you, that's really frightening. So sometimes, you know, with trauma, early trauma, we actually shut down our MindSight abilities so that we're not perceiving the negative mental states of people who we're supposed to depend on. So that can be a way where we kind of are protectively not developing MindSight. And so sometimes people who've been through trauma either are flooded too much with what's going on inside, or they've tried to shut it down in order to not know their inner worlds of their caregivers. So in either case, you know, there's work to do when you've been through trauma regarding, you know, balancing out your MindSight abilities.
And that was one of the things that I love so much about your description of MindSight, because it, and you talked about this integration piece earlier, but it brings together kind of what always felt like a separation for me around mindfulness practices. It felt like this separation from self, and not dissociation, that's the wrong word, but like a bypassing of, right, as a protective yeah. measure, and can be taken too far, especially as a protective measure, as you just said. And it makes sense if your caregivers hurt you, that super sensibility of being able to really perceive their intentions and their inability to care for you in the way that you deserved, cutting yourself out for that would be really difficult, just like you said. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly, Megan. And I think, you know, it's really an important point you're raising that, you know, if you've gone through trauma, then these ways that you're learning to relate to others and to yourself are really going to be impacted from very early on. And the great news about that is that your mind can actually overcome these ways of doing it. And I think actually, even though you said, you know, maybe it's maybe a little too extreme to call it dissociation, one of the things about mindfulness is a vulnerability is that it allows you to get into kind of a spacious awareness, which on the one hand has a lot of potential for healing. And on the other, if it's not done with a lot of support, can be a kind of dissociation, meaning a disassociation from your feelings and your memories and your thoughts, because you kind of retreat into this spacious awareness that if it's done in that way, it is a kind of dissociation. So we don't want that to happen, but it's one of the vulnerabilities that we have. So to really carefully allow someone to enter an open state of awareness and say, you know, bring it on. I want to feel my feelings. I don't want to become this kind of numbed out human being who doesn't feel things, even though that might have been a strategy when I was younger, so that I could, you know, have all these painful things going on but not feel the pain. Mm-hmm. What we want to do as the healing process goes on is really allow ourselves to be fully present for all those emotions, and yet at the same time have the skill of being resilient and not flooded by them. So this is a kind of, that's why the word integration is kind of the way of seeing through that. You differentiate the feelings from each other and then link them. That's what integration is, differentiating, linking. And in that process, you feel them fully, but you're not flooded by them.
Feel them fully, but not flooded by them.
Yeah.
I really like that distinction. I want to come back to a couple of things that you said, but I also want to speak to what I think you kind of inferred to earlier, which is this idea that sometimes people think that people without trauma think that people with trauma, it's a much more voluntary experience than it is. the forget your feelings and move on kind of crowd. So I want to talk about implicit memory, because you talked about it in your latest book and didn't talk about it explicitly as it related to trauma, but that it felt so related in such an obvious way. So if you could talk to us about what implicit memory is and how it develops and how it takes part in our development of trauma.
Yeah. Well, in Interconnected, this last book, you know, there are many layers where implicit memory comes in. And implicit memory basically is, if you think about it this way, memory, that word, really means how an experience at one time will be encoded into our nervous system and will influence our future ways of thinking or recalling things, literally bringing back to mind, or behaving even. So it isn't just the simple things that we usually think about. Oh, I remembered this morning, you know, I took the dog for a walk. That's a kind of memory, but there's other layers of memory that are before that experience. So those layers include, you know, the way you're perceiving something, like what you see with your eyes or hear with your ears, the way your body feels, so a kind of bodily sensation, the emotions you have, you know, like anger, sadness, fear, or even the behaviors, like learning, you know, to walk or being able, you know, walking somewhere, walking the dog. So all those foundations are laid down in the brain during an experience that's called encoding. You then store them, and that's a change we believe in the connectivity among neurons. And then at a future time, you're taking the dog out for a walk again, you know, you would then retrieve something about those foundations of memory. So that's the encoding, storage, and retrieval part of any memory. But then you've got this way where the brain summarizes experiences in something called schema or mental models and even gets you ready. So if the dog is barking, you know, maybe she knows you're going to take her for a walk. I shouldn't talk too loud because I have my dog here. If I say walk, she'll probably say, let's go, Dad. So those things are called implicit, and they're called implicit because, number one, they're at this deep level, and that's the feeling tone of implicit. But also, when you retrieve them, if they're in their pure form, you don't have the feeling, oh, I'm remembering something now. You're just walking the dog, right? So when I heard that years ago, that implicit memory in its pure form isn't tagged with a sensation, oh, I am remembering something now, even though you are retrieving a memory. I had been working with people who've been traumatized and kept on asking my supervisors, why do people have flashbacks and post-traumatic states? What's going on with that? And they say, we don't know. And here was some interesting findings, not from clinical memory research, but just from basic memory research. So I started speaking with those researchers who had made that discovery in the 70s. This was now in the early 80s. And I thought, well, what if the part of the brain that allows implicit memory to be taken to the next step, which is called explicit memory? And what's that next step? It's where in the right side of the brain, you encode what's called episodic memory or autobiographical memory, remembering yourself in time walking the dog. Or on the left side of the brain, that same hippocampus on the left side is encoding things to factual memory. I know the fact that this dog is walked by this person called Dan at various times. I don't have a feeling myself doing it at a particular time. I just know the fact about it. So factual explicit memory and autobiographical explicit memory, sometimes called episodic, meaning you're remembering an episode of an experience. When those are mediated through the hippocampus and they're stored and then retrieved, they have the feeling to them. I call it an ekphoric sensation. Ekphory is the process where a trigger connects with an encoded memory that's in storage so that you now retrieve it. So ekphory is that matching of the trigger to the stored memory. And that sensation, that we don't have a name for it, but I call it an ekphoric sensation, meaning you're going, oh, yeah, this morning I walked the dog around the corner and I ran into the squirrel and my dog tried to chase it and almost pulled my arm out of my socket. You know, so that's an experience I remember because it was raining or all these things. So self and time has a quality of, oh, yeah, I was there. Or factual is, I don't remember when I was there, but I know the fact there was the dog was walked by me. I don't know. I don't remember it explicitly from an autobiographical point. I remember it explicitly from a factual point. So in working with patients, what was really interesting was to notice that sometimes people would only have implicit memory for an experience. And that would come up as a flashback in a traumatic, post-traumatic, you know, condition. Or it could come out just as like, I don't know why, but there's a feeling of familiarity, but I'm not sure. Well, you actually walked the dog, Dan, this morning. Oh, yeah, yeah, that's it. That's it. And the squirrel, there's something about a squirrel. I don't know what it is. So the hippocampus, this is my hypothesis, the hippocampus during trauma is flooded by the stress hormone cortisol. And there are lots of cortisol receptors on the hippocampus. And it temporarily shuts down. So if you block explicit encoding and have pure implicit encoding, it basically explains much of post-traumatic stress disorder. And then what became really important about that was that the clinical interventions could use that model and do directed work to retrieve implicit memory from its stored place. So now it's in consciousness. So this is not the same as non-conscious memory. Because any memory that's only in storage and hasn't been retrieved yet is not conscious. So this is not the same as unconscious memory, even though a lot of my colleagues will say, oh, implicit memory is unconscious memory. I go, no, that's just not true. Implicit memory, when it's stored, is unconscious, just like explicit memory, when it's stored, is unconscious. What's different is that when it's in consciousness, pure implicit memory doesn't have the tagging of I'm remembering something from the past, but it's fully in your awareness as an emotion, as a bodily sensation, as a behavioral action, and even mental models that I believe, you know, all dogs should be walked. And you go, Dan, why do you believe that? You go, I don't know. I just, it's a feeling I have. All dogs should be walked. And I will develop a whole edifice and organization around that belief. All dogs should be walked. And all the people who believe the dog should be, you know, and they're now all
I'm
these
just sitting here thinking about your poor dog.
she's taking a big nap. It's raining here.
She's like, ah, he does this all day.
He does. He uses me. That's all he wants from me. He's using me as an example. She's so cute. You wouldn't believe it. She's a rescue pup. Anyway, so so this is just where, you know, the first time this became really clear, besides with my patients, but in everyday life, was a colleague of mine had been yelled at by her therapist. She was leaving town because she was transferring to another job. And she said, oh, you know, before this is our last session, I need to tell you about all this trauma I had as a child. And he goes, why? What's wrong with you that you leave this important fact out for the last day of your therapy? You're really not a good patient or whatever. And she was so upset. So she said, all this time I had just a feeling about these memories, nothing clear, you know. So then I explained to her about implicit versus explicit memory. She started crying. She said, that just explains my whole life. You know, and so the good news about it is you at any age can start integrating this implicit layer of memory into explicit. And then the next layer would be to move from just explicit facts and explicit, you know, autobiographical memory into what's called an integrated narrative, where now you find meaning in the memory. And that's, you know, this whole journey of integration that I think therapy is really all about, to go through these different domains. But anyway, yeah. So That's a long answer to a short question, Megan.
It wasn't at all. And in fact, you teed me up to my next question perfectly.
Oh, okay.
I couldn't have done it better myself. Yeah. So I came to your work originally through your parenting books, kind of co-written, or not kind of co-written, very much co-written by Tina Payne Bryson. I've interviewed her for our relationship conference as well.
Oh, great.
And I have to tell you, as someone on a long path to healing my own trauma and extremely determined not to pass it on to my children, your work, and Tina's for that matter, has made the biggest difference in my life.
Oh, great.
And it was first, it was that I didn't anticipate this, but by reading your books, I was able to first use it all on myself. And I think this is by design. It was no accident.
As it should be.
Exactly. No accident to you, but it was a surprise to me. I was like, oh, I have to do this first and then I can apply it outside. But, you know, helped me heal old wounds and integrate experiences and rewrite those narratives, as you were saying. And then I could turn it outward to the way that I relate to my children, not try to change them and their behavior, but just how I relate to them. So I'm hoping that you can describe what I found so hopeful about not having to be a perfect parent in order to be a good parent, and how that relates to the four S's that you describe that are essential to healthy, secure attachment.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, first of all, I love Tina, and I'm so happy that the books that Tina and I wrote are helpful for you. You know, Tina and I never would have written a parenting book had I hadn't not written a book with Mary Hartzell called Parenting from the Inside Out, which, you know, really took the research finding that's just like what you're saying, Megan, you know, first know yourself. If you really want to help your kid, take the time to reflect on what happened to you when you were a child. And that's the book Parenting from the Inside Out with Mary Hartzell. And, you know, once Tina knew that book and was studying my other work, you know, on a more professional, you know, academic level, you know, she started having kids. And then we said, hey, you know, let's do this project together. So that project turned into four books, which we're very excited about. So, In Parenting from the Inside Out, though, what you do is you get a summary of what the inner work would be about knowing yourself and where you've been. And then what Tina and I did, this was after Mary passed, but we wrote a book called The Power of Showing Up, which kind of is, and in some ways is a direct extension of Parenting from the Inside Out, only saying, here's, as you've done the Parenting from the Inside Out work of showing up for yourself, now how do you show up for your kid? But you can't, the research is really clear. If you haven't shown up for yourself, it's going to be really hard to show up for your kid. So what does showing up mean? Well, showing up means these four S's you're talking about, you know, and the next book I'm writing is a book on how temperament leads into personality, into adult. So temperament in childhood leads into adult personality. And these S's are actually relevant there, but that could be for another talk.
I can see how they'd be relevant, though, because depending on how your temperament was incorporated into your family system by the adult caretaker in your life, that can determine a lot about how you turn out as an adult, I imagine.
Exactly. Well, exactly. And, you know, there's a whole nother, I'm so immersed in that book.
I bet.
I'm writing it with several colleagues, and it's been taking about 17 years to have it finally be completed. And we're like in the very last couple of weeks. So it's a very exciting time. But anyway, so I don't want to get flooded with that. But in terms of the S's, you know, what the S's are is being safe, being seen, being soothed, and being secure. So let's go through each one of them. Remembering that, especially as we go through them, there's no such thing, as you're pointing out, of perfect parenting. And one of the, I think one of the biggest personal challenges I had to ever writing a book for parents was the fact that there is no such thing as perfect parenting, that I knew myself as a dad, there are all sorts of ways I messed up. So the way I took that on directly as a therapist, as a, you know, educator, and as a writer, was to really start with what I'm about to say, which is that it isn't about being perfect as a parent, it's about being present. And by being fully present, by showing up in that way, you realize you're only human, so that mistakes and flub-ups and, you know, miscommunications and disconnections, all those things are going to happen. I've met one person where it kind of didn't happen, and that had its own problems, actually, that everything was always controlled, you know, like this. And so when you're spontaneously fully there, stuff is going to happen. You know, you miss an opportunity to understand what's going on, or you're too enthusiastic and you missed a subtle clue, or, you know, you had something in mind that was so important to you that you were so devoted to what you wanted to say that you didn't really listen well, and all these things, you know. And so, you know, in all my books, I write about the mess ups I've done. And my kids were younger, and they were old enough to read what I wrote, and I gave it to them before I published it. I said, you know, is this accurate? And they'd say, yeah, this is accurate. But why would you want to share with the world what a jerk you can be? You know, and I go, good. I mean, that's exactly what I want to convey, is that you can actually be a writer of these books and mess up so fully your kids think you're a jerk. And read the part where I said, and once you've shown your jerk capacity, you then come back and reconnect. So even though we're going to go through these S's, it's super important to say you can have a direction you're aiming for, but realize, since you're human, which is a good thing to be, and since you're role modeling for your kids, which is really good, that you can make flub ups and course correct. You can always begin again. And the worst thing is to act like the flub up didn't happen and just pretend like it didn't happen, or assert that, oh, it happened on purpose because, you know, it was good for your kids that you acted like such a jerk or whatever. No, just say, whoops, wow, that was not right what I did. I'm so sorry. What was that like for you? Oh, it was so scary. You did this, you know, it must've been a dream I had the other day, because I have a chapter in one of my books called The Crepes of Wrath, where I got really wrathful at a crepe store. And I think it was a dream I had last night, actually, maybe getting ready for this talk with you, with this conversation. It was like, oh, look, someone actually did some kind of jar that said Crepes of Wrath or something like that. Now I'm realizing it was a dream. It wasn't a reality. Okay, so what is the S's? The first S is safety. And that's literally what attachment is all about, is your child is going to be protected from harm by you. And sometimes something's not going to go right and you missed an opportunity to protect them, or you might have even been the source of terror for them. Now, you know, mistreating children is not good, and it's better to recognize that you're doing it and then stop it and make a repair and then do your inner work so you don't do that again. It's much better to do that than just pretend like what you just did didn't happen. Now, that can be physical, of course. It can be other ways, you know, where you're yelling and screaming and scaring your child. So safety is really, really important, because if a child is terrified of their parent, and I don't mean frustrated with you because you didn't let them have ice cream before dinner, I mean terrified of you because of what you did. Even if it wasn't what you were doing to them, you might have been yelling at the TV because of some political issue, or you might have come home drunk, or you might be dissociating yourself because you have unresolved traumatic issues. So not even abuse, direct abuse, but actually just terrifying behavior. That needs to be repaired. So safety is number one. Number two is seen. And being seen means that the inner life of the child is focused upon by the parent, and it's sensed and respected and responded to in a timely and effective manner. And as one of my first patients ever, you know, said this to me, it's the best phrase, and I'd like to quote her, but I'm not allowed to give her name because she's my patient. I can see her right now as we're speaking. She said at the end of therapy, when she got better, and I didn't know why she got better, because I didn't do anything my supervisors told me to do. So I said, yeah, you know, and she said, yeah, oh, I got better. It's obvious why I got better. So I said, I know it's obvious, but how would you put words to this obvious thing? She said, never before in my life have I ever had the experience of feeling felt by someone. I went, wow. And she was my, you know, first teacher, really, of how therapy works. Because all these theories and all these approaches, you know, they just never made sense to me. But she really taught me, you know, this importance of, you know, your inner life was really felt by another human being. And that's what MindSight allows you to do, you know. So that's what being seen for a child is. They're no longer alone in the world, and they're a part of a we without losing the me. You know, so that's what seen is. And of course, ruptures to that happen all the time. And we make a repair. We make a repair. And it isn't that repair means you're a bad parent. The repair means one thing. It means you're human. And you're role modeling for your child that you can have a direction you're trying to go in a relationship, and it doesn't always go that way, and you become aware of it. You reflect on that disconnection from what you're intending, and then you make a reconnection, a repair, and you rejoin. No big deal. You can make a big deal and beat yourself up, but then you're missing the reality that you're human, and you want to teach your child, hey, humans do this, but they don't just let bad things happen. They recognize, whoa, that was bad. Now I'm going to correct it. Doesn't mean I'm a bad person. It means the action was harmful, was not respectful, wasn't kind, whatever it was. So that's the seen experience. The soothed is really, you know, the fact that when we're in a state of distress and we don't feel good, connecting with someone who we really trust to make us feel better. So soothed means I felt bad and now I feel better. I mean, that's what it really means. And, you know, I was just writing an article with one of my colleagues at the Institute, our MindSight Institute, you know, and when you really get down to the simple things, this soothe things is actually quite simple. It's really an integrated connection. So honoring differences and promoting linkages for really interesting reasons allows the system of the we to take a distress state and bring it into a state of harmony. You know, and so there's a whole physiology of that, but we don't need to talk about that now. But it's really important that it's the subjective experience that you're tuning into, that being seen, the child feels safe. So these all go together. And now within that sense of trust, they can really connect with you even in a space of distress so that they feel joined and now they feel better and they don't feel alone. And when you have those three S's and when they're not there, the repair is made of the rupture, then you get the fourth S, which is secure. So ideally, you know, we all would have something in our lives like that. Unfortunately, you know, for about a third or even more people these days, they don't get that on a reliable basis with their primary caregiver. And, you know, the way the brain develops to try to get along day to day to survive that kind of suboptimal attachment is a part of what is the legacy of, you know, what's called insecure attachment. I call it non-secure, because it isn't that you are insecure. It's just that your experiences were not optimal and you adapted the best way you could. So that's my problem with the word in the research literature of insecure, is that people think, oh, that's an insecure person. No, that's not what that means. It means that person adapted the best they could to a very non-optimal situation. So even, that's the story of the four S's.
I always like to also give the caveat that it doesn't have to be with any malicious intent from the parent either, right? Like, this happens a ton from people who just cannot, because of their own limited capacity, for whatever reason, meet the needs of their children in one of these ways. For me personally, I had a chronically ill parent, right? And that wasn't her fault that she was chronically ill through my childhood. But that meant a lot of the time I wasn't seen, I wasn't soothed, and led to a feeling of a lack of safety, right?
Absolutely.
Doesn't mean that I had a bad mom. It means I had a bad situation that led to a lot of this stuff. Yeah.
What's been the most helpful for your journey towards healing and integration?
Ooh, he's turning the tables on me. He's good, y'all. No, I would say realizing that creating safety and feeling seen and feeling soothed is first and foremost an inside job, and has to be done by me, for me, and not, and it can, you know, and maybe people with trauma can relate to this, but there's a tendency of, there's a voice inside people who are recovering from trauma who's, I can't trust anyone, it's always going to be me, right? So at the beginning, that felt scary, of that kind of inside out job of the I need to do this from the inside out. I can't depend on anybody else, because that's activates that voice of like, I can't depend on anyone, no one will ever take care of me, blah, blah, blah. But it's not that. It's from a truer place of self. It's from a deeper soul connected. This is the care I deserve to give myself, is the care I deserve to get. And so I'm going to figure out how to meet those needs in that way. And then what ends up happening is that everyone around me wants to see me and soothe me as much as I do for myself.
Yeah. Beautiful.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, it totally makes sense. And, yeah, that's really inspirational.
Oh, thanks, Dan.
Thank you, Megan.
I'm happy to be at your conference now. I've turned the tables back around on you. We're running not short on time, but we're going to have to wrap up soon. And I cannot let you go before I talk to you about the story that you shared. And I'm not sure, so let me know. I think it's the first time you shared the story, but in interconnected about your fall from the horse. Is that the first time that you shared it?
Well, it's the first time I've shared it in that much detail. Absolutely. Yeah.
So if you could tell us about it, only because it's not only like that is technically in clinical speak, like a trauma that you suffered, but it also gave you a perspective that shaped your work for many, many, many years to come that I find both fascinating, I would just love if you would share whatever you're comfortable sharing.
Sure. Well, I mean, the literal thing, Megan, you're asking me about is when I was just before I turned 20, I was working down in Mexico for the World Health Organization. And in one of the projects, I was studying curanderos, folk healers. I was going up to a small town called Huaula, and I was going to interview the queen of the mushrooms. And it was very exciting. And, you know, I didn't have any experience with that. And I was really looking forward to deepening my learning of folk healing. But I was going with two colleagues. Actually, one was a colleague and one was a boy who lived in the house we were staying in. And we had three horses. And on the full gallop we were going, and I love riding horses, my young horse had inflated his belly enough so that at the gallop, the air escaped his lungs and his belly and everything like that. And so the saddle got loose. And unfortunately, the saddle turned to his belly. My feet stayed in the stirrups. And then I was dragged for a long time, 100 yards, my colleague told me. And, you know, besides damaging my face in a very serious way, I lost my identity. I had no idea who I was. So for about a day, for about 24 hours, I didn't have much language and didn't have like a, you might call it a narrative identity. So everything was like new and fresh and kind of hilarious, actually. I was laughing a lot, even though I had all these broken bones. And it was just like magical. You know, things were shimmering and colors were like glowing and it was just wild. And then after about a day, you know, my name came back and my identity came back and my explicit memory of like, you know, who was I? What was the fact of this person called Dan? And what were the, you know, what were the facts involved in him getting here? And where was I and all this stuff? And, you know, I never understood it till years and years, decades later, you know, what significance that had, but it really shifted my relationship with my identity, that I never took it really quite as seriously. Or when people would call me Dan, which is my given name, you know, or Daniel, you know, a part of me inside of myself would be laughing like that can't really be something that's solid, a narrative identity, the identity of the story, who you tell yourself to be, if it could get knocked out by a horse accident like that. So later we learn, you know, the regions of the brain that probably got temporarily, you know, for 24 hours disabled from the head hitting on the stones, that we can understand that that was kind of knocked out of commission for a short period of time. So I had no identity, no narrative identity, but I had full awareness. And this was the fascinating thing, is you can be completely aware. And awareness was different from the narrator. Very different. And, you know, now we know that in various, you know, mindfulness practices, we were just talking about that when we got started, or even in psychedelic uses in medical research, they're finding that the ability to loosen up this narrative identity of a separate self is actually probably the key feature to treating all sorts of very serious conditions like depression or anxiety disorders, certain aspects of trauma, or even people facing a terminal illness and facing death.
OCD so as that, well, aspects of like obsessive compulsive disorder and things I heard.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, there's a practice called the Wheel of Awareness that I talk about in the Interconnected book, where the states of awe that you get in the center of the wheel, this hub of the wheel, pure awareness, are very much like the experience of awe in these different interventions that expand the sense of who you are. And the reason I wrote the book Interconnect, and the reason I start with that story of the horse accident, you know, is that the book is really all about who are we really, and what does culture tell us that we are, and that maybe the message from the larger modern culture is actually a trauma-inducing message. What I mean by that is there's something that we call epistemic trust, which is when people who we're supposed to rely on are telling us trustworthy things consistent with reality. We call it epistemic, which is how we come to know what we know, trust, where you can rely on somebody. So it's a violation to epistemic trust to be told that the self is separate. So this is where the interconnected word comes in, where you, okay, well, you are a separate body and you are connected to other bodies in nature. So we're interconnected, but actually there's a larger self that is intra-connected as a part of the woven system of the whole. And what if we could actually have both the inner me and this relational we, and the interconnected experience would be mui, you know, M-W-E. So the feeling of this body, Dan, is that any opportunity we can have, like Megan here speaking with you and everyone listening, you know, to identify this lie of the separate self and its trauma-inducing repercussions, and liberate ourselves from that so that we realize that as a human family, we're all woven with each other. But as a family of all of nature, we're all woven with each other. So, you know, I think that's the big, big trauma of modern times that's leading to racism and social injustice. It's leading to polarization and even leading to environmental destruction. So all of these things are very traumatizing, and we can actually identify the kind of splinter that's in the soul of the psyche of modern society and take it out by realizing the self is not just in the body. You are a me and you are a we, and together you're a we.
And I know you touched on it just a minute ago, but part of that, that's the reason you developed the Wheel of Awareness practice, right? Was to help people cultivate that sense of we and the sense of interconnectedness. Am I correct in that?
Well, it was sort of the reverse. You know, the two ideas were that integration was the basis of health, and consciousness was needed for change. And then with my patients years ago, I had them try out integrating consciousness, which was putting the knowing of consciousness in the hub of a wheel, putting the knowns on the rim, and then moving a spoke around to link them. And in the course of doing that, well, one of my patients came up with the idea to bend the spoke around and just aim attention right into pure awareness. And their whole sense of self expanded. They felt connected to everything and everyone. This sense of love emerged. And then I did it with other patients. They started having similar experiences with my colleagues and students, you know, therapists. They had this. I'd started doing workshops. I did it with, before the viral pandemic, 50,000 people in person. And this was a really common experience. And that's kind of where we came from, was actually it came from just the practical experience of trying to help people integrate consciousness that was helping them in all these ways, that then this larger sense of self was liberated.
Beautiful. Wow. Yeah. Where can people find out more about you and your work and the Wheel of Awareness?
Yeah, well, come to our website, and this, we have two linked websites, but the one to come to for the Wheel is Dr. Dan, so DrDanSiegel.com, and there do the Wheel of Awareness. There's all sorts of free videos and stuff. If you want to take courses, like get a real deep immersion, there'll be a link when it'll say courses. It'll link you over to the MindSight Institute website, and there's a, you know, whole, you know, online program that you can dive into. And
fantastic.
Welcome.
Wonderful. Dr. Dan Siegel, thank you for being with us today.
Megan, thanks for having me. It's been a real pleasure.